Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. I am here with the one and only my good buddy, Joseph Wang, Fed Guy. Joseph, welcome back to the show, buddy.
Hey, George. Good to see you again. Pleasure to be here.
Okay. Now, you put out a tweet the other day talking about the price of gold. I want to dive straight in to this topic because I think it's extremely important. And I'm paraphrasing your tweet, but you're saying something like you're actually concerned that gold is hitting all-time highs. And what I gathered is, okay, this might not be hitting all-time highs due to inflation, but more so the insiders buying because they see increased geopolitical risk, which is what I'm seeing on the front page of CNBC right now as we speak. So do you want to expand on that?
Yeah. So George, like you noted, gold is hitting an all-time high. It's not just that. It looks like it just goes up every single day, right?
Yeah.
Especially in the Asian trading hours. So that's been kind of a mystery. No one really knows why. When you look at gold, it's really hard to make sense of it because there are a lot of different frameworks people use. If you're like a traditional macro investor, you say, well, real interest rates, right? If real interest rates are negative, well, you might as well buy gold. Otherwise, your money's burning away. But if you look at real interest rates today, they're historically quite high, about 2%. So it doesn't make sense for gold to go up. Some macro investors also look at gold like it's a currency. So they would say that if the dollar is strong, gold prices go down. If dollar is weak, gold prices go up. But if you look at the dollar, it's strengthening, and yet gold prices keep going up. So if you're looking at gold from a traditional macro perspective, it doesn't make sense. Now, some other frameworks to try to help understand the gold price would be, of course, central bank buying. And we all know that's happening. The Chinese central bank, for example, is buying lots of gold. And so one of the things that I'm thinking might be happening is that you just have really heightened geopolitical risk, and you maybe have these big foreign actors that are trying to prepare for something big and buying gold in advance. Because what we learned over the past 2 years between the Russia-Ukraine conflict is that when you do something that, you know, the establishment doesn't like, they will just freeze all your foreign reserves, which is what they did to Russia. And not just that, right now they're talking about taking all that cash and giving it to Ukraine. So giving it to people, your enemies, basically. Now, if you are, let's say, a foreign power who's not on the same side as the US, that's really concerning. So before you do anything big, before you do anything that might upset everyone, you got to prepare ahead of time. And that preparing ahead of time would involve getting rid of your dollars and euros and buying something else that's not as vulnerable. And maybe that's what's driving gold prices. And we do see a lot of, you know, headlines of geopolitical conflict. Like you mentioned, we have what's happening in Eastern Europe. We have what's happening in the Middle East. And these are all linked, right? The players, let's say Russia, let's say Iran, let's say China, these guys are kind of in the same club. So it could be that they're moving towards some kind of event and just having to prepare ahead of time. Now, the way I think the market for gold isn't really deep. You know, it's not like treasuries or it's not like Apple stock. You can't buy a whole lot of it. So a lot of these guys, maybe they have a lot of money and you just can't squeeze a whole lot of money into this small little market without making the price move a lot.
Yeah, I saw on CNBC referencing that story. Basically, what's happening is the United States is asking China to intervene with Iran because Iran is blaming Israel for the attack, I think, on the Syrian embassy. I think that's what it was. And there were seven Iranians that died as a result of the attack. And you got the Iranian leaders saying that, well, this is Israel's fault, and therefore we're going to attack them as payback. And then you've got Israel saying, okay, well, if they attack us, then we're going to attack them 10 times harder. And then you've got the United States supposedly saying, well, wait, whoa, time out, guys. And they're trying to beg China because they have a better relationship with Iran. And that's probably US's fault, but China has a better relationship. So they're begging them to come in and intervene and try to mediate this process. And I'm always someone that defaults to assuming the financial insiders have a lot more intel than we do. So Stan Druckenmiller, George Soros, Paul Tudor Jones, these guys know firsthand what's going on with the relationships because they know these political leaders. And if they don't, their banker friends know them. And I think it's why the curve inverts and why that's been such a powerful predictor in the past is because these guys just get, it's not even illegal information, although I think they do get illegal information, but it's just information that we don't have access to. And so to your point, the fact that gold is going up right now, it is a little concerning from that standpoint.
So these, a government, I mean, think about it from a company's perspective, right? If you're a company, let's say you have a big earnings announcement, oftentimes what you see is someone making a big options bet beforehand and then benefiting handsomely when the earnings.
Yeah, happens. Right.
So someone already knows. Now, if you think about, you know, a country, a government is like a ginormous company, right? Whenever it wants to do something, let's say it wants to prepare for some kind of military action, well, that involves like thousands of people driving around in trucks. It involves a lot of vendors. It involves a whole lot of coordination. There's no way that someone doesn't know. Someone always knows. And like you mentioned, George, these guys, so they're going to talk, and someone might be positioning ahead of time in the market for that. Now, for these geopolitical events, of course, I don't actually think it's illegal because you're trading these global commodities. It's not like you're trading on, insider regulated company. And besides, those guys, they are oftentimes international in different jurisdictions anyway. So I definitely think this is something that could happen.
I was reading not one of the Market Wizards books, but it was a similar book called Inside the House of Money. I think that was the title. And it was talking about a guy that worked for Julian Robertson. Is it Julian Roberts or Julian Robertson with the Tiger Fund?
The Tiger. 90s? Yeah. I know who you're talking about.
So this guy worked for Julian Robertson, I think his name is. And, he and George Soros at the time were kind of head to head. They were the top of the shelf, let's say. So anyway, he was working for Julian Robertson, and they were doing a deep dive on palladium, I believe. And for whatever reason, I guess Siberia is one of the big producers. So this guy that was being interviewed told the person doing the book that Julian Robertson flew him out to Siberia for like 6 months to try to interview all the people at the mines, just the entire supply chain for palladium, to get any bit of information that would give them an edge on trading this commodity. So when you read stories like that, you just have this light bulb moment where you understand that, okay, this is what's going on with these huge hedge fund managers, and this is why they have access to that information that, you know, to your point, could be making gold go up right now for all the wrong reasons.
And to your point, I mean, listen, when policymakers leap, they give speeches for $500,000 an hour, right? They're not great speakers, but maybe they have information. So yeah, there's definitely some information out there that most people don't have access to.
Have you found anything in your research that has some sort of correlation with gold? And what I mean by that is, I did a whiteboard video the other day, and everyone thinks, well, it's the inverse of the dollar. No, it's not. You just go back 20, 30 years, there's very little correlation. They say, well, it's positive real rates. That's not it, because you can do the exact same thing. I say, oh, it's an inflation hedge. No, that's not it either. There are times where, yes, it goes up with inflation, then times it has an inverse correlation. So it seems like, if you just look at it over the span of 100 years, you know darn well that it's going to maintain its purchasing power. But you know, from year to year, I mean, who the hell knows what drives it? Other than it seems like a lack of liquidity makes it sell off, and then maybe geopolitical risk usually makes it go up.
Well, one thing to keep in mind when analyzing gold, especially over long time frames, is to be careful and note that the monetary framework changes over time, right? Once upon a time, gold was money, dollars and everything pegged to gold. But that changed over a few decades ago. And so that's going to make any historical analysis of gold quite difficult. Now, just as you note, I think gold, the relationship between gold and other variables really does change over time. And it's really not a good inflation hedge. Just look at what happened over the past few years. Now, in 2020, we did see gold shoot up a lot. But when we had significantly higher inflation in 2021, gold really didn't do anything. And it kind of just sat there for the past few years. Mm. And if you note that some people even look at, let's say, M1 and gold as a relationship, and I think that was a big driver of gold prices right after the great financial crisis, when people were looking at quantitative easing, thinking that we'd get hyperinflation and gold was shooting to the moon, but that didn't happen. And of course, even as the Fed has been shrinking their balance sheet over the past year, we've seen gold prices rise. So that's not a good stable relationship either. So gold is really tricky. There's all these different regimes. It changes all the time. So I think what I find useful is just to use judgment and context. And right now, it seems like gold is most sensitive to one is to upcoming monetary easing, global monetary easing, and to geopolitical risks. So that seems to be what's been animating the market right now.
Let's talk about something maybe even more complex, and that's inflation and trying to figure out if it's going up, if it's going down, if we're going to have deflation, disinflation, if we're going to have reflation. I've been hearing that word a lot lately with all the commodities spiking. So can you first and foremost give your view on where you see inflation over the next year? And then I want to try to think about that through the lens of M1 and M2.
So just to level set a little bit, inflation, of course, soared as high as CPI, let's say 8%, 9% an annual rate, but then it steadily came down. Most recently, it looks like it's stabilizing about, let's say, 3%, 4%, where it's been for the past few months. So inflation looks like it's sticky and comfortably above the Fed's target. Now, I expect this to continue because one of the big drivers of inflation is the fiscal deficit. Now, that's going to be the big variable that's going to make the future look different from the past. Now, the CBO is projecting that the fiscal deficit is going to be about 5% forever going forward. Could be even higher, depending on who we get in office. What I've noticed is that the president, no matter which party, likes to spend more money. So I think of the 5% deficit as a minimum. Now, the reason why it's really hard to shrink this deficit is because it's driven by things that you really can't change. A big driver, of course, is the aging population. Baby boomers age, they collect Social Security. Social Security is inflation adjusted, and they need more medical care. Medical care is really expensive. The second thing that they can't really change is the interest payment. A big part of driving the deficit going forward is just the tremendous size of the debt plus high interest rates means that the interest expense is really high. So as we have this ongoing fiscal deficit, we're going to have structurally higher inflation. This is actually really easy macro. It's something that we see over and over again across cultures and across time. When you have a government that goes and goes and has a large fiscal deficit, it's basically buying things and paying for it by printing money. Debt, government debt is a type of money. And so that's going to keep inflation, I think, 3 and 4% for the foreseeable future. And that's something that I think we're going to have to live with until it gets worse. And I think it will get worse.
The key there is government debt is a form of money.
Absolutely.
That is what very few people understand, because they hear you say money printing and they just think of the Jerome Powell meme.
Yeah.
It's like money printer go burr. And what you're really saying there is that you've got savings. And so the treasury replaces savings with a treasury, which is a cash equivalent asset.
Exactly.
And they take that cash and give it to someone else. It turns into checking. So on balance, M2 hasn't changed, but in reality, the aggregate balance sheet has increased with cash equivalents. Therefore, the money supply has increased, and that's how you're defining, quote-unquote, money printing. Because that's a much different definition than most people use.
Now, another way to think about this is that what money is something that is in part dependent upon technology. Now, just think back, let's say 20 years ago, if I had to pay someone, I had to write a check, right? People use personal checks and it takes a few days to cash. It's not super liquid. Now, if you go back, let's say 100 years ago, let's say you had treasury securities. Well, it is liquid, but you know, it's not, it's more like kind of a CD almost, right? So the market liquidity is there. But fast forward to today, it's super liquid. The market is super deep. So it becomes a lot more cash equivalent. Mm-hmm. And so as it becomes more cash equivalent due to advances in technology, due to increased sophistication of the market, it becomes more and more like a cash equivalent item. And so when I'm thinking about money printing, I want to keep the outstanding public debt treasury market as a part of it. Now, this wouldn't be true for all countries, right? Let's say that you are Mexico or Brazil, as you print, let's say issue a lot of debt, that is not going to be as liquid, not going to be as cash-like as treasuries. So if you issue a lot of them, maybe it's not going to have the same amount of, upward pressure on prices as a treasury would, because it's not as cash equivalent. So that's how I'm thinking about this. And that's why my base view going forward is that this is really going to have upward pressure on inflation. But more importantly, it's going to have tremendous upward pressure on asset prices, which is really what you see throughout history when you have really high deficits. Asset prices, real estate, equity markets, that stuff goes to the moon.
Yeah, that's interesting that not all government debt is created equal. As far as being a cash equivalent, I've always thought about that through the lens of treasuries, but I've never thought about it through the lens of like Mexican government debt or something like that. And then also, Joseph, how do you see the change in, because we're not talking about an increase of M2 or M1, but we're talking about an increase of the aggregate balance sheet. But what I think would be applicable is a change in the composition of the money supply. And I would argue we would be changing the velocity, because you're taking savings money and turning it into checking money. And if it's checking account money, most likely that's going to be used to buy Chipotle or food or shelter, car insurance, et cetera. Or if it's savings, by definition, it's most likely not out there chasing goods and services. So how do you think about the velocity component of the government spending, even if the Fed isn't even involved?
So I think the government spending, velocity is, so I think government spending is positive for nominal growth, but velocity thing is a little bit trickier, because on the one hand, maybe you have more nominal growth, but on the other hand, the stock of money-like stuff increases. But I'll give you some stats to let you know how I think about this. So in the U.S., basically the bulk of taxes, the vast majority of taxes are paid by people who are in the upper 5% of income. So if you have someone who's making $1 million a year, that person is going to spend some money on going on buying goods and services, but the bulk of it is just going to be buying assets or investing and stuff like that. So what having a large, fiscal deficit means is that you are basically taking money from either higher earner people who have a lot of income, or just really rich people who want to invest, and giving it to people who are more likely to spend. So the propensity of consume is higher for low income people than for higher income people, right?
Yep.
So when you have this big fiscal deficit, you're just kind of redirecting resources towards people who are more likely to spend it. And so that's going to be supportive of nominal economic activity and inflation. Now, I'm saying nominal instead of real, because when you're talking about real, there's a lot of other things that go into it, like technology and so forth. So all I can say is, and let's say population, for example, what if you have a lot of fiscal spending, a lot of demand, but there's just not enough people to fill up all the jobs, then all you get is nominal growth, not real growth, because you don't have any more man hours. So I'm talking things just strictly nominal speaking, but that's going to be positive for nominal growth.
How do you look at inflation or the type of inflation you're referring to? There are these inflationary pressures with a backdrop of an economy that has too much debt and therefore fundamentally is deflationary. So my point there is, could we see this government spending increase velocity or deficit spending, money printing, to use your terms, could it just be anti-deflationary instead of inflationary?
So I think when you're talking about the deflationary impacts on debt, it's really important to make a distinction between public debt and private debt. Now, public debt is not deflationary. Why? Because in order to pay it off, the government just prints more money, right? It just keeps borrowing. Now, if the government, let's say we were back on the gold standard or something like that, and in order to pay its debt, the government had to raise taxes. Well, yeah, for sure. Raising taxes, taking money from one person to give to another, that's deflationary because you're taking away income from the private sector. Now, if you are public debt today, though, the way that the U.S. government pays off its debt is it just continues to borrow more and more, continues to print treasury securities. That's not deflationary at all. It is inflationary. Now, with respect to private debt, again, we got to have a little bit more nuance here. Private debt levels are going higher. But like, you know, if you are, many people on this channel are really savvy real estate investors, you know, you got the liability side, right? The debt, you got the asset side as well. So when you look at a consumer private sector balance sheets, you can't just look at one side. The debt level is high. The asset level is even higher. Now, one way to look at that is to look at house prices, right? The level of house prices over the past few years has surged by like 20 to 30%. So the net worth of the private, of the households is at all-time highs. Now, that's one thing. The next thing to look at when you're looking at the private sector is to look at the flow, not just the level, but the flow. Now, broadly speaking, if you're looking at, let's say, households, a lot of people have locked into mortgage rates at, I'd say, 3%, right? So even if their level of debt is high, now they're locked in at really low mortgage rates. Their income continues to, let's say, go up with inflation or something like that. But the mortgage payment is not that big of a deal simply because they locked in low rates. Now, looking at the company side, it's a bit more complicated. But what seems to have happened, and the big reason why we've raised rates so much and it doesn't seem to have impacted the corporate sector so much, is that in 2020, when a lot of people were really scared about what was happening, they hoarded cash. Corporations went out and borrowed far more than they ever wanted, locked in really low rates. And the maturity wall, to the extent there is one, is really staggered over the next few years.
Right.
So looking at a flow perspective, their debt load is just not a problem simply because, one, they have a lot of cash, and two, a lot of it is still locked in at rates that are quite low. So that's not a recipe for deflation.
What if banks are lending less?
Banks are
like I'll look at loans and leases, and I'll look at bank credit, and although it's ticked up recently, it's flatlined, and then it was way, way below trend. And then I don't know what M2's done recently because I've been in Argentina, but it had gone down first time since the 1930s. And then M1, I think, was down substantially as well. So when I think about inflation or like high oil prices or the wage price spiral or something like that, I understand the argument there, but I'm like, look, if the banks are creating less debt, and therefore the money supply is going down, at some point, I think rubber's got to meet the road, and it, the higher oil price is an example, would actually be deflationary because they're having to rob Peter to pay Paul. Whereas if we have the 1970s, you would see bank credit really going up and loans and leases going up. And therefore I totally see how you'd have sustained inflation in that environment.
So bank credit is definitely not growing strongly. Like you mentioned, it's ticked up a bit, but let's say last year it was really flat. So one of the things that we would expect to see in an inflationary economy is for the banks to create a lot of credit. That's where the money comes from. And that fuels ongoing nominal spending. So it looks like what happened the last year is that as the Fed raised rates significantly, and as we kind of had a scare in the regional banking sector, banks kind of, well, one, didn't want to lend as much, and two, because of higher rates, people didn't want to borrow as much. So that's been something that is not inflationary. Well, they're not contracting though either, so I wouldn't say deflationary either.
Yeah, that's where I kind of come in with that anti-deflationary.
Yeah.
It's like the banks are just going to keep it super simple. The banks are putting this downward pressure on inflation because they're lending a lot less. They're not creating enough money supply to fuel higher and higher prices. While at the same time, the government is spending.
Right.
A tailwind to inflation. So that's, I mean, is it possible to get them equilibrium where they cancel each other out? Hey guys, I want to invite each and every one of you to join me May 31st through June 2nd in Orlando for Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the annual conference I do, and this year it's going to be absolutely incredible. We're going to have some of your favorites there as speakers, guys like Jeff Snyder, Mike Green, Real Estate, Kenny McElroy. We're going to have Robert Barnes. They're talking about freedom and liberty. Even Rich Cooper is going to be there discussing red pill issues. This event is all about giving you the intel, the insider information you need to not only survive 2024, but thrive. The whole reason I created this event was to give you the tools you need to build the future you deserve for yourself and your family. This is an event you are not going to want to miss. So to get more information, go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. You can see a full list of speakers we've had in the past. You can see clips from past events. And most importantly, you can get your tickets. As we get closer to the event, the tickets go up in price. So you're going to want to get those ASAP at rebelcapitalistlive.com. And we will see you in Orlando, May 31st through June 2nd.
So I think the government is spending is much more powerful, and it compensates for the lack of credit creation in the banking sector. So I think over the past 10 years, if you look, let's say loans and leases, I think the banking sector would create, let's say, well, $500 billion a year. Government spending right now, looking at the deficit, it's like $2 trillion.
Right.
Okay, so maybe 1.7, something like that a year. So it's far greater than the banking sector. Now, one thing that I'll note is that when we look at this relationship between banks and credit and, you know, economic activity, it's going to be different for every country. In, let's say, Latin America and in Europe, they're much more bank-centered. And so a lot of what the bank does is key to understanding the economy. But in the US, we got a whole lot of other things as well. We got, for example, the capital markets. If you're Amazon or Google, you don't really borrow from a bank. You go and you issue a bond. So the capital markets in the US, really deep. So that kind of sidesteps the banks. And that's been quite robust this quarter. The second thing is, a part of the reason that banks haven't been lending as much is not having to do with anything economic, but having to do with regulations. And that's kind of why you have this full court press right now to try to roll back some regulations. It's not as profitable as banks for banks to make loans as it was before. So you have the rise of these shadow banks called private credit that are just surging in growth, and they're making a ton of loans because, you know, there's a lot of cash in the market, and they are not under the same kind of regulations as banks. And so some of the growth that you would have seen in the bank sector has gone to private credit, which is growing tremendously.
Right. So what chart do you look at to determine that shadow lending? That makes a lot of sense.
So there's not good public data, but there's actually, there are private data vendors that do this. There's this recent paper by the Fed on this topic. I believe they're saying, showing that it's about $1.6 trillion now and growing rapidly. So I can send that to you later. But so why do people like to private credit? Why is private credit becoming so popular? Or if you're an investor, you can get 10% in private credit. And if you're a corporate borrower, why do you want to borrow from private credit? On the one hand, maybe you can't get a loan from a bank because you're just not a good credit. On the other hand, private credit is oftentimes faster than a bank.
Now, wait, it's just like hard money with real estate lending.
It can be.
Well, that's what I mean by that, Joseph, is I tried that once. I never really was a big fan of it, but I wanted to try it to see how it worked. And I remember when I took out a hard money loan, it was at like 10% interest or something. This would have been like 2014, something like that. And with the banks, I was having no luck. Like, they wouldn't give me anything. They wouldn't even give me a line of credit at 40% LTV. But I could get a hard money loan, and they're actually very, very easy to get, even though the interest rate was much higher.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me. So maybe the bank, because the regulations are more conservative, maybe because there's this panic in the regional banking sector, they pull back. So you have these hard money guys, these non-bank lenders step in and fill the gap. And so that could be part of the reason as well. Now, curiously, the data suggests that default rates for these guys are actually pretty low for these private credit lenders. The caveat is that when there is a default, the recoveries are also much lower. So,
Yeah, so they're not, so that wouldn't technically be increasing the money supply, they're just redistributing it.
Exactly. Exactly. And
they're just getting it circulating where the banks aren't willing to circulate it because of regulation or risk management or whatever. These guys are willing to take that additional risk and because they're getting compensated for it. So you just get that, I guess you could call it velocity or circulation.
Exactly. These guys, they're not banks. They can't create money. So what would happen is that there'd be someone wealthy who would lend them money, and these private credit managers would then go distribute it to a company through a loan, and the company would then spend. So it'd be exactly like you said, it'd be circulating this money.
Yeah. And it even though it's not creating new money, it is creating new loans.
Yes.
That would increase the liability side of the aggregate balance sheet.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Huh. That's really interesting, because then you have an increase on the aggregate side, but I guess you would have an increase on the asset side as well, because that new loan on the private entity would become their asset, which was the offsetting liability. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Offsetting
exactly. Liability for the borrower. It just expands the system.
Yeah. Not that helps you sleep well at night, but all right. So let me see here. I had a couple things written down. Oh, you know, a funny story about Argentina that I wanted to tell you and Josh quickly here before I forget is, have you met Ali, Joseph? The Venezuelan gentleman that works for me. You know Adriana.
Yes.
Yeah, Ali is her husband.
Oh, okay.
And right before we went live, he was giving me kind of some of his input on the whole Argentina trip. And he said that when he was in Venezuela prior to fleeing and coming to Colombia, he actually participated in the Venezuelan version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Remember that game show?
Yeah.
Where you answer in each question, you
million pesos. Well, I don't know. Not going to get many contestants there.
here's the funnier, or from his point, the sad part of the story is he actually got really far. He was a contestant and he got like 13 questions right or something. I think like each question, you can either take the money or you can risk it by trying to answer another question correctly and then adding to the pot. And so he got like 13 questions right and cashed out at the equivalent of like $10,000, which was huge money for him, right? But the problem is the game show didn't pay him for 6 months. And when he actually got the amount of pesos that was $10,000, when he actually got it, it was only worth about $100.
Mm. These guys are clever. And you know, they do that for the lottery winners too, right? They make it into like a payment. They pay over 10 years or 20 years to try to save a little bit of money. So
yeah, they probably do the exact same thing there. All right. So let's see. Let's go back to kind of what we're seeing with the stock market. And I'd like to get your take on NVIDIA, the S&P 500, the Mag 7, and could we be seeing a rotation from tech into commodities, if it is true that what we're seeing with the prices are telling us that we should expect reflation?
So we definitely do see commodity prices rising. So, but not all. I mean, gold, obviously, silver, probably related to gold.
I think copper too.
Copper, aluminum, yeah, those are going up. Cocoa, of course, going to the moon.
Forget Bitcoin. Cocoa, buy some chocolate.
And you
chocolate.
Can eat it too, right? Yeah. but stuff like iron ore and steel, not doing that well. And that could be related to, let's say, what's happening in China. So broadly speaking, if you look at a commodity index, it is going, broadly speaking, higher. And I think that could be linked to some extent to a couple things. One is that, well, we're entering into a global easing cycle where not just the Fed, but the ECB, central banks around the world are expected to cut rates in the coming months. And usually when people see rate cuts, maybe they would buy something that's a bit more tangible. Secondly, it does seem like the manufacturing sector is having a resurgence. So when we look at the data, it looks like the manufacturing PMIs are kind of turned the corner. And so maybe that could be driving some more industrial demand as well. Now, when you're talking about things like NVIDIA and the tech stocks, so NVIDIA absolutely going to the moon. for sure that there's a lot of speculation there, and it's speculation everything AI related. So, but I would be cautious about that because things like this, they can really go higher than you can ever expect. It's already gone higher than I've ever expected. The business there is really good. They definitely have a monopoly on a leading edge product that's in demand everywhere. So their earnings, obviously going to the moon, orders keep rising. And so it's not without reason that their stock price shoots up. Now, more broadly speaking about the equity market, like I mentioned before, my base case scenario is that we are heading into what people commonly think of as a crack up boom led by runaway fiscal spending. That is going to be hugely, I think, positive for asset prices. Now, it's going to be terrible for the country, terrible for the Republic, but it's really positive for asset prices. And we see this over and over again throughout history when there's a government that just kind of doesn't manage itself very well fiscally. So normally you would also expect to have inflation, and I think we will have inflation. But I think the more immediate thing for us would be to have high asset prices, because a consequence of what we're seeing now is that there's tremendous, unevenness in the distribution of income. So when the government continues to spend, as it pumps money into the system, what I've seen is that because maybe the market is not super competitive, it accrues to very few companies, accrues to very few people. And because income is unevenly distributed, the wealthy people get a lot of income and they tend to buy assets. And so the stuff that the wealthy people like, they inflate a lot. And most people like things like equities, they like things like real estate and other forms of financial assets. So I think that's the funnel. So deficit spending increases nominal income, it accrues to few people, and the few people who have large incomes buy financial assets.
Yeah. So the moral of the story is go out there and load up on Truth Social. Go ahead.
Truth Social, not having a good week, but it had a good debut.
I said that was as unpredictable as death and taxes. I actually did a video the other day prior to going to Argentina making fun of Truth Social and how it was just complete blow off top, and how I was thinking about shorting it. But anyway.
Be careful about those things. That's all hopes and dreams. President Trump has tens and tens of millions of fans that he can definitely, I don't know. It's hard to evaluate that. It's kind of like Tesla, right? Tesla, Elon Musk, tremendously popular, strong following. A lot of people just like him.
It's like GameStop or any of those. That note, Joseph, what do you think, because this kind of pertains to what you're saying about this idea of financial nihilism. I heard Grant talking about it the other day with a gentleman, I can't recall his name. He's in the Bitcoin space, but it makes a lot of sense. And, I grew up in the 1970s, the 1980s, early part of 1990s. And I just remember back then, nobody talked about investing as a way to get rich, like buying stocks, like nobody. The only way you would get rich is just going out there and starting a business. But now it's the complete opposite. And I can see why. I'm not blaming the younger generations, but it gets to a point where it's almost rational for them to continue to buy call options on the most volatile stock with anytime they come up with an extra $500. And if the government is spending more and more in the future, and we see this bifurcation, could that lead to more and more of this financial nihilism, which could lead to more and more of these, this piling in, this herd mentality into these meme stocks?
I think it's one of the things that I've learned, interestingly, is that something like this has happened before, be it in revolutionary France in the late 1700s, or even in Japan during the 1980s. When you have these big financial booms, it becomes so much easier to go and get the fast money, just to go and gamble. And people don't really have as much interest in having these, work at a job, start your own business, hard work stuff. It's so much easier to to just go gamble and make it big. So I think there's definitely an element of that, especially I think for most people, the level of prices has risen so much. You know, if you have a normal job, it's really difficult, for example, to afford a house. And that hasn't always been the case. So I can understand if a lot of people feel like their only way to make it would be to just gamble in the markets.
I'm just worried that gets worse. If we do have more fiscal, if we do have more inflation, we have negative real wages, just I don't know how it gets better.
These things never end well. But between now and when it ends, it could be for some time. So also be an opportunity if you were to recognize that this is the world we're in, to do quite well. So
yeah,
back then, I would say that in, let's say, revolutionary France, when you had high inflation, but when you had the stock market going to the moon, it totally, totally ruined all the working class people. They had to subside on government rations. It ruined the merchant class as well, because all their products, you know, they really couldn't sell them. The government would have price controls. It ruined the traditionally wealthy as well. But in that period, the people who did really well were the speculators, because they realized what was happening and they took advantage.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the next thing, you know, you got 30,000 people headed to the guillotine. Right? Usually that's how that stuff ends, unfortunately.
Yes, that is historically accurate.
What do you think about this idea of the lack of issuance with the 10-year treasury yield inverting the curve? A lot of people have asked me, and this is a concept, I think a gentleman by the name of Michael Howell has been, I don't know Michael, and I've never.
No, I met Michael last month in London. He's a great guy.
It seems like a really bright guy.
Yeah,
but he has this. A lot of people have asked me in Rebel Capitalist Pro and whatnot that what I think about his idea that basically there's just very little issuance at the long end, and there's a lot of issuance at the front end, and that's basically why the curve is inverted. I don't buy that, but I'd love to hear your take on it.
So I'll explain that point of view. So how do you think of, so traditionally, when people look at the 10-year yield, they think of it as composed of two things. One is the expected path of Fed policy, and the other is a little bit of premium on top of that to hold it. So let's say that you expect Fed policy for the next 10 years to stay flat at 4%. Okay, so that would mean that, let's say, the 10-year at least has to be 4%, otherwise you just roll overnight in Fed funds. So you want to have a little bit of premium on top of it, because you're taking risk, interest rate risk, for example. So let's say 100 basis points premium, voila, you get 5-year, 10-year. So what a lot of people are pointing to right now is that the term premium for this 10-year treasury security, which is a model-based measure, is either negative or, you know, very close to zero. So the thinking would is that maybe if you increased issuance in the 10-year tenor longer dated treasuries in general, you would have the premium go up, and that would help uninvert the curve. So that's how that line of thought, I believe, comes from. Now, of course, everything is supply and demand. If you issue, let's say, $10 billion, $10 trillion of 10-year treasuries, yes, interest rates will go up, and so you would uninvert the curve. So
now, is there a point there? Let's think that through. Because say they just deluge of supply, there's $5 trillion or $10 trillion of treasuries, that 10-year, you know, long end of the curve, that come onto the market via Janet Yellen over the next 5 months. So that initially spikes rates, but then doesn't the risk reward for holding those treasuries change significantly to the point where they're far more attractive? And then that brings in much more capital, because if you want to say that 10-year treasury is a combination of future growth and inflation expectations, if they're dumping, $10 trillion, that changes the growth and inflation expectations slightly in the short term, but in the long run, it really doesn't. So if you're one of these hedge fund, the Paul Tudor Jones types, that's buying the treasuries to begin with because you think we're going to have World War III, if the rates go from, let's just say, 4.6% up to 5.6%, well, hey, that's an even better deal. And I'm going to come in and I'm going to sell my T-bills and I'm going to go ahead and buy the 10-year because it looks a lot more attractive. And then that brings the rate back down, maybe not to where it was at the beginning, but it doesn't make it explode higher to the point where we'd have a bear steepener.
So it's going to be a dynamic process, and everyone is going to have a different perspective on as to how this influences the economy. So yeah, you could just have more issuance, and then you kind of go up and down, market finds more buyers, more sellers, and has a different equilibrium. So but all things equal, if you have more issuance, that's increasing the supply. And yes, it does probably, well, it doesn't actually even necessarily imply more spending either. You could just, the Treasury could just be changing the profile of their debt. So
yeah, right.
That's something to keep in mind as well. But, if it does impact, more spending, yeah, maybe that impacts how investors view the economic fundamentals.
Yeah, there's what this teaches you. I think the main takeaway there is, regardless of your opinion or your conclusion, you realize how complicated these things are, how many variables and cross currents go into interest rates, inflation, etc.
Oh yeah, I mean, just like we were talking about, some people look at this as a combination of expected growth and inflation. Other people would look at this expectation of Fed policy plus term premium. And other people, let's say that you are a foreign reserve manager sitting in China, well, you don't look at any of this. You have more dollars. Yeah. You can only buy treasuries. Well, money in, I buy. So there's a lot of other people who look at this differently.
Yeah, that is interesting. I tried to figure out how much 10-year issuance we've had in 2024 or over the last 12 months, and then compare that to what we may have seen in 2019 or 2016 to determine if there is a big difference, and then what I should compare that to. Like, should I compare that? Let's just say that we're issuing $500 billion this year and we did the exact same thing in 2019. Well, should I be reconciling that with like M2, or should I be reconciling that with the overall debt issuance? I was trying to think that stuff through, but again, it's complicated.
So it's complicated, super complicated. And I think there's two factors to keep in mind when doing this kind of analysis. One thing is, of course, what is the Fed doing? So if you just look at in the past, let's say in 2020 or 2021, we had a lot of issuance, but also the Fed was buying a lot too. So what the private investors had to take down actually wasn't as much as the issuance would suggest, because you had the Fed helping. And going forward, now, the Fed is going to step back a little bit, taper QT a little bit. But when you look at issuance, you also have to keep in mind just how much the Fed is stepping back. The other thing is, I think of this as, let's say, pouring water in a cup. Let's say I pour water in a cup. Okay, cup is half full. Easy. But if I pour the same amount of water again next year, maybe the cup overflows because it's already half full. So if you are an investor, how much cash does your investor have, or how much access to leverage does the investor have, right? Can the investor easily lever up and take these down as it did before? So access to finance is something that I think will eventually be a bottleneck. So far it hasn't been, but I think eventually it has to be, simply because you have all these strict regulations that limit the banking sector's ability to provide this leverage to the investor class.
Just, you don't have to go into it because I know we're running short on time, but just for my own research, what do you think, which regulation has the biggest impact on banks buying these treasuries or creating loans right now?
Oh, that's a tough question. So actually two different questions. So when it comes to treasuries, it's very likely what's called the leverage ratio.
Okay.
The leverage ratio is
that's the SLR, right?
Yes, it's the SLR. Okay. Because it's not risk weighted. So if you are a bank who, let's say, makes a loan to to Bitcoin hedge fund, it's going to be the same risk weight as making a loan to the U.S. government, according to the SLR. So that's going to discourage a bank from making these less risky loans, simply because the capital charge is the same, but the return is much less, not in proportion to the risk. Now, when it comes to the private loans, So what I've found out, you know, I used to talk to a lot of banks, is that every bank is in a different situation according to the regulations because they have different business models. Now, for example, if you are Wells Fargo, you know, you're basically just you're just a giant local bank. You don't actually do any really fancy stuff. If you are Goldman Sachs, you're doing a lot of fancy stuff with, you know, hedge funds and all sorts of, you know, institutional clients and so forth. If you are JP Morgan, you have a mix of both. So every bank has a different business model. And because of that, they have different, their binding regulations are different. So it's not going to be one size fits all. So generally speaking, the smaller the bank, the less it's about regulations, and it's more, it's just about their own business, because the small banks aren't under a really binding or regulations. That could change. One of the big things that could be happening is you have a suite of regulations called the Basel Endgame, which is going to try to take those big bank regulations and move them down to medium-sized banks. And that's been getting a lot of pushback. But if that happens, I would expect, well, at least the banks, every older bank just saying that that's going to make available loans much less available because it's more expensive to make.
You know, what's funny. Did you see that quote from Jamie Dimon the other day in his investor letter, where he said that JP Morgan is perfectly positioned for the end game? That's what he said.
That's what he's talking about. It's the Basel III end game. So I follow the Fed, right? So the Fed, Jerome Powell, goes to Capitol Hill to have these Humphrey Hawkins meetings. Basically, the Congress and the House and the Senate each have a day where they get to grill him. And if you listen to it, it's really interesting, because every congressperson is asking Chair Powell about the Basel III endgames. You'll have this person who's like, my farmers and so-and-so are really concerned about Basel III endgame because it's going to impact their costs. And, you know, that's nonsense, because there's no way that you have these random ranch farmers who are complaining about Basel III endgame. But that's what they're saying, right? So everybody, full court press, really hate these new banking regulations. So I think they're going to be changed, but there's a tremendous amount of pressure on the Fed to change them.
If you're really JP Morgan, wouldn't you want that? Because it's just like a mega corporation wanting the government to raise minimum wage because it creates a moat around their business. Yes. Where no one can compete with them.
They have said that before. I would say the first time Basel III came in, not the end game, they're like, well, you know, this is a moat because you need all these compliance people and, you know, we can do it easily. Other people, not so much. So, yeah, that could make them stand out relative to their peers. But I don't know. Maybe they would make more money without all these costs, too. So I don't really know how that shakes out.
And as someone that worked at the Fed, who on earth comes up with these names? Like, that is seriously, who sits down and thinks, you know what we should call this? We should call it the end game, because that doesn't insinuate anything nefarious. Do they have a PR department that just kind of reviews this and says, you know what, that's probably not a good idea?
They do have a huge PR department. I'm not sure. Maybe they play video games a lot. Maybe they think this is really cool. I don't know.
Unbelievable. All right.
Yeah, it's not the end game. They're going to have Basel IV too. Basel continues forever.
Gee, it's going to be like a Rocky movie. All right, Joseph, thanks a lot for coming on, buddy. I'd like to remind everybody to get their tickets to Rebel Capitals Live. Joseph Wang is going to be there. You can ask him your questions. You can have a beer with him. You can sit there, rub elbows. He's going to give an amazing presentation. So this is something you're not going to want to miss. You can get your tickets at rebelcapitalslive.com. And Joseph, where can the people find more about what you're doing? Tell them about the YouTube channel, the Twitter, etc.
Absolutely. Well, first off, thanks for speaking with me. Really looking forward to meeting everyone at Rebel Capitalist Live. Now, if you're interested in seeing more of my work, I have a YouTube channel, Joseph Wang, where I post weekly videos on what I think is going on in the markets. And of course, you can follow me on Twitter at FedGuy12.
All right, Joseph, thanks a lot, buddy. We'll see you in Orlando.
See you soon.